be in LA.
Oh, okay.
Doing all right today?
Yeah.
All right. Good. Thanks for spending some time with me.
No problem.
Ready to roll?
Mm-hmm.
All right, Austin, Texas. What are your thoughts on this fine city when you arrive, when you're departing, and those random times when you're looking back thinking about the city?
Well, I usually look forward to it because it's green, it's kind of nice. I don't remember ever having a bad time in Austin. It's kind of a music town. A lot of people I know, like, or knew, you know, throughout the years playing music, would end up like spending some time here, either living here, moving here to live, or living here for a couple years. So I always found kind of curious. I mean, it seems to me, given some of the people that I know that have moved here, that it must be like a city of some of relative tolerance, you know, suspended in Texas, which I think is really great. I've always had great shows here. I've always had great shows across Texas. I remember one specific thing that happened when Soundgarden first came here, and it was in, it was probably on tour for the first Sub Pop record. This was the first time we ever came here. And I came to Texas, period. And, you know, I'm in a band with one guy who, where both his parents are from Bombay, and another guy where both his parents are from Tokyo. And they're afraid of being outside of their own world and being in the South and being in Texas, you know, because they're afraid people aren't going to treat them well because they're not white, you know, that they're going to, somehow we're going to get in trouble or they're going to get lynched. And we came into this convenience store in Austin, and I walked in, me and Hiro walked in and to ask directions how to get to the hotel we were going to. You know, it was like a Motel 6 kind of a thing. And this guy was unloading a beer truck into the convenience store. And he was unloading like flats of like 20, 24 per cases of beer into the store. We go in there and we ask directions. And here I had just a really bad attitude about Texas, about being in the South and not being white, you know, just the whole thing. Which I kind of, I had to allow for that because, you know, what do I know? I don't know what that feels like. And we get the directions. We go to walk out and we're getting in the van. And the guy who's unloading the beer comes up to the van with a case and he knocks on the window and we open the door and he says, "This is from the Austin Welcoming Committee." And it was obvious it was the first time we were there. And he gives us 24 case of beer and walks off. And I thought, like, okay, so this like Texas hospitality thing is not, it's not a myth. It's just like, because that shit doesn't happen in Chicago or Seattle. Nobody walks up and gives you a case of beer because you look like you're from somewhere else, ever. And so that, it made us feel like so good and so like welcome and comfortable. You know, first time we're away from our home ever and traveling around the country by ourselves. Didn't have any money, didn't have anything. You know, we didn't even have cell phones then, you know. So that was like one of the coolest things that happened to us in my early years of touring, and it happened here.
What was it like, what was the feeling doing another solo album after working with such great bands and players over the years? How'd it feel?
Great. I guess I can say I've been really lucky with different people I've played with, but also, you know, I've always brought a lot to the table, so it's like, you know, whether it's Soundgarden, Audioslave, Temple of the Dog, whatever I've done, I brought a lot to those records and to those bands. And I always knew that I could do things as a solo artist. I just didn't necessarily want to. Soundgarden was kind of a band where it was bigger than the sum of its parts, and I kind of knew that. I knew I could make records outside of Soundgarden, but it would be a different thing. And I also knew there would always be time to do that. You know, I knew Soundgarden wasn't a band that was going to last forever. I didn't know how long it was going to last. But I, you know, ever since doing Temple of the Dog and other side projects pretty early on in Soundgarden, I knew, you know, I can kind of do whatever I want when I want to do it. And being in that band, I was mostly focused on that. And even, you know, when I was an Audioslave, I was mostly focused on Audioslave. So, but I never felt like you know, as Chris Cornell, I'm going to have trouble finding great musicians. And the band that I have now are unbelievable musicians. Some of the songs that we're playing that are old songs, I've never really done them as well, I think. So it's kind of a situation of, you know, if you're a person that puts everything you have into something and you need other people, or you want other people to do that with you, you're going to get great people, if you know, because you're that focused. I've always just sort of looked at it as being, if there's something wrong with my band or my own record or anything, I'm going to just view it as my fault. And have always looked at it that way, and hasn't hurt me so far.
Tell me a little bit about the players you're playing with now.
You know, they're all like, I don't think any of them are from L.A., but they're all musicians that I met in L.A. and going through an audition process like anybody else would. Except for that, I suppose it's like what people might think, I guess, you do something like that, maybe you're looking for the best players. Some bands are probably like, they're not looking, they don't even care about who the best players are. They're looking for, like, people who look right. I'm not really sure. I wasn't really looking for either of those. I was looking for the people that sort of got the spirit of the music in such an extended framework of like 20 years of recording, because it had to be a musician that gets what Soundgarden did in 1990, but also gets what I'm doing on my newest record that's not even out yet. And that's not that easy. It ended up taking a lot longer than I thought. And it also ended up being kind of obvious. Like, I didn't have like a list of musicians where there were runners-up or people in second place. It was kind of like, you know, I would find a guy and there was no one else on that list for that guy. And I just ended up being lucky and actually finding two guitar players and a bass player and a drummer that I totally got 100% behind. And also, you know, it's really interesting because they would be playing songs from whatever period, you know, an old Soundgarden song or a Temple of the Dog song or an Audioslave song. And I'd show up at rehearsal, they'd be rehearsing it, and there'd be people outside the door listening, and I wasn't even in there, and they weren't from any of those bands that they were playing the music of, and it sounded incredible. You know, it was like, and it was obviously more than just a cover band or a band, you know, putting something together so they can make money. These guys really got it and really loved playing the music. And that, I could feel like I'm lucky that's happened. I can't imagine, like, any of the guys that I'm working with sort of not being there and someone else being in my place. And then there are things about it that feel strange. It's the, like, Audioslave was the same thing to me. It was the three guys that live in California that I've never met before and me forming a band. The only difference is, like, I wrote songs with them and now I do it on my own. But, you know, the first time I went out with Audioslave, it was like, oh, I have to kind of get to know these people and how they do things. And it's not Soundgarden anymore. This is like that, too. It's like, it's all new guys, and we're playing songs. We're getting amazing reactions. I'm able to play songs consistently live up from my catalog that I've never done before because of their level of musicianship, you know, because they can go all across the boards and do songs that are technically pretty difficult and still destroy songs that are just pretty simple rock songs. And we've done, I don't know, 10 shows together. Every one of them's been great. But it's still like, you know, we're a family and they're just kind of getting to know each other.
What was the last unpopular stance you've taken? And how did you deal with the fallout and what was it?
I don't remember. I don't know that I've ever really gotten, like, a huge backlash for anything I've ever done. You know, I don't know. It's a musician and a famous recording artist, what stance would I take that would be unpopular to the people who like my music and go see my shows? One would be like, if I were an absolute 100% unqualified fan of the Bush administration, that'd be very unpopular, and I'd get fallout from it right away. But I'd also get like a lot of supporters, I'm sure. I don't know. I think to a certain degree, most of my attitudes are pretty well accepted by the people that would have anything to say about me. And I've never been like the type of commercial superstar where you say something, the opposition will be so threatened by it and take such offense that they'll respond dramatically to it. I've never had that big an influence, I don't think, on the commercial populace to be considered any threat for anything I've said. So I don't know. Somehow I'm relatively unscathed. Can you think of one?
That's something that you've done? No.
Yeah. I can't really. Not a big thing.
I thought maybe you'd pull something out, like I told my wife we were going to vacation in Miami. You know, I had no idea what you would answer with.
No. No, I was thinking more in terms of like saying something in the press that got like, a bad reaction to it or something.
Right, like the Dixie Chicks or something.
Yeah, or become sort of feud-like, or somebody that gets in a fight with Howard Stern over something, you know, that kind of public feud kind of thing. Because I've had friends in bands that's happened to. Like, she'll follow you forever, too. But it hasn't happened to me.
So what do you think is the significance of hope and encouragement, specifically for the artist, but also for the general person?
Well, I think you have to have some of it, or you're probably not going to be able to get through life. You know, there has to be some amount of hope and encouragement and some spark of something that gets you out of bed in the morning and gets you toward the next day, gets you to work and through your work day and then back home. And I think that where that comes from isn't so simple necessarily. Like, for example, when I was younger, if I was listening to music that could be perceived as dark or depressed in terms of its topics, it didn't make me depressed. It, if anything, would make me feel better, hopeful. Like there's a, you know, like when you read a book and you read an author that might have been dead for 200 years saying something that you thought you were the only one that thought of, you realize you're not alone. That kind of thing. So when I would do interviews sometimes and people would accuse me of writing depressing, dark lyrics and what do you have to be depressed about, that kind of thing. You know, it never made a lot of sense to me. And I don't think that it has that effect on a listening audience. I think that there being a connection is encouragement. And there won't be a connection if it's not natural or normal. You know, if the song doesn't come from the right place, there won't be one. But in other words, you can help create that encouragement and that hope in a lot of different ways, not just by like writing "We Are the World." In fact, I think that's really a depressing song. Nothing makes me more depressed than fake hopefulness, I gotta say. Sometimes, you know, when I'm going through the channels and I'll see like evangelical Christian shows where they've got singers, you know, and they're singing songs, and I just don't get any inspiration out of that at all. I just think, like, you know, something's missing. I feel like they're not really feeling it, that they're just up there singing it, and TV cameras are on, and they're wearing more makeup than anyone I've ever seen, and it's something just totally fake about it, and the music is not inspiring me at all. So, the whole idea is the message of hope and encouragement there, and I don't get any of it. And I'm sure there are like tons of Marilyn Manson fans that were brought up in a particular way and raised around particular people, or maybe they didn't feel necessarily connected to anybody, and they listened to a Marilyn Manson record and realized that there's some family of Manson fans out there that also feel disenfranchised, and then they're part of something. That's great. That's not a bad thing at all. But I wouldn't be sitting here today if I didn't manage to continue to find hope for myself or encouragement or like hope and encouragement in and about humanity, period. Other people. I mean, I've gone through different periods of my life where I didn't have a lot of good things to say about the human race in general, and, you know, depends on what I would want to concentrate on. I don't really feel like that anymore. I think it depends on where the focus is and how much I'm exposed to and affected by media events. You know, like the Virginia Tech shooting. It's like one guy that went berserk and killed 32 people. And if I sit around and think about that, it doesn't make me have a lower opinion of humanity. You know, it's, if you even just look at the math of it, it's one guy killed 32 people who were defenseless. It makes me concerned about just the structure of society now, because for some reason we seem to be producing people to do this kind of thing more often and on a larger level, but just billions of people in the world that aren't doing awful things and that do amazing things. So, you know, I just have to keep my mind focused. And I think anybody that's ready to go and do some crazy motherfucking thing should remind themselves of that too. You know, it's not just a world full of awful, horrible, selfish, sinning, evil people. Most people I think are good. And I've been in arguments with friends about this subject, you know, for hours. I don't think humans are inherently evil. I think that I actually think that humans are great, and they're just easily corruptible, unfortunately.
The music you've made over the years has seemingly captured some of the magic that roots rock and roll was a part of. In a way, it's like you've touched the spirit and captured the flesh. Have you ever done the opposite and reached out towards the flesh and captured the essence of the spirit?
I think I've probably done both those things in equal measure, kind of. And I think that's sort of where my focus is now. I don't really want to make an attempt at anything when I'm writing a song now. And I don't want to be concerned with the outcome so much as just the process of doing it. Because I spent years where the actual process of sitting alone and writing songs was kind of terrifying, arduous, it was lonely, and then it had its moments of, like, feeling great and triumphs and like, you know, it was very fulfilling as well. But a lot of it wasn't. And part of that was being so concerned about what the end result is while I'm doing it, before it's, and I'm anywhere near an end result. Nowadays, you know, I find that I'm not really reaching for anything other than enjoying writing music that day and letting, like, the inspiration take me wherever it is. I try to focus on, you know, whatever the first thought and the first inspiration is, because I feel like that's the most honest one. Maybe it might not be technically the best one, but usually it's the one that people will connect with the most. And then the outcome inevitably seems to be something that does capture the essence of something somehow. I think it's easier to do it without letting my fingers, which are clumsy, or my brain get too involved in it, which is kind of new agey, and I always think of that as being really silly, but it is sort of a way that I've approached moving forward songwriting wise and feel like there's something in there big time that I'll sort of just stumble across at some point. I think it's a good thing.
I'm glad you're doing that.
I was going to say something else, but I don't remember now.
Mentioned you're doing both in equal parts.
Yeah. Well, that in my career, I think, has been what has happened. You know, I think, and I think it's kind of unpredictable.
even if it's all intellectual. Like the song Big Dumb Sex was completely intellectual. It was like making fun of Madonna and George Michael, you know, and really just the pop music media, where they'll play song after song after song after song, with sexual innuendos and every word that can be used to describe fucking except for the actual word fucking. But if you use the actual word fucking, everybody gets completely freaked out. And so it was completely whimsical to write that song, Big Dumb Sex, and have the word fuck 35 times in it. And the lyrics are completely benign, just stupid sex lyrics, but with that word in it. And so many people reacted to it in ways that were not great. It was like, one of them was, there were people at A&M Records at the time that didn't want to work there if A&M Records was going to put out music like that and release it to the general public. Now, this is at a time when NWA was releasing records. And they were actually saying things. They weren't just making fun of pop music and people's avoidance of the word fuck. They were actually saying hardcore shit. And one of the other responses that was so weird was, and this was the one I liked the least, was we would start doing it live in shows, and I would start seeing sort of meat-headed guys, usually kind of bigger guys, that are singing the lyrics and pumping their fist in the air, and it's become their new sort of meathead anthem, you know, because they think it's, Soundgarden went ahead and wrote a song about that because that's how they feel about things. And it became kind of like this beer drunken kegger anthem. That wasn't really the point either. So we stopped playing it. But it was funny because really I actually did have an intellectual idea in mind for the song, but no one ever really picked that part out. They looked at it as being offensive and sexist, although it's not gender specific at all. Or they looked at it as being like, you know, the rock anthem that someone finally got around to writing. It's pretty amazing.
What do you think about Jesus Christ?
I think he was like a really great guy, really, probably really smart, really caring, and absurdly committed to his beliefs. Smarter than, when I say smart, like intellectually, he's pretty damn smart and manipulative. Someone that could have done anything, been anything. I believe in the basic stories about his life because they're corroborated by people from different walks of life at the time. Some had more education, some had no education. They're all telling the same story. It's never really happened before about religious figures. I think that Christianity as a religion is very little of what his message was in most of the offshoots of it, certainly like the bigger ones. There's a paper trail of that. You can go into a library and read all about all of the different Christian churches and their subsects and at what time they came to being and why and how much of it was politics and how much of the, you know, what the Bible's made up of and what books and scriptures were put into it and why and what time and who voted on it, and all that stuff is available to read. And you know, I think it's completely, his original message is completely corrupted, completely. And almost sort of turned upside down, and has been used for purposes to like get troops together and military over the centuries and to steal from other people, wipe out entire cultures. And I would never suggest that one guy's responsible for any of that. It's just like another example of the corruptibility of human nature and how fucking far it can go without people kind of realizing that it's been that corrupted. I mean, it's incredible to me. Or you know, sort of taking the idea of faith in goodness is great, but following particular rule book without actually going and researching where it came from and realizing and then that it's corrupted and it's edited by people who probably weren't good people and for reasons that have absolutely nothing to do with religion, I think the follow that blindly is sort of dumb. I mean, we all, people, as human beings, have a responsibility to get to the bottom of stuff. I mean, God gave us brains, not so we could just blindly follow. That doesn't make any sense.
What do you think about his claims to be, quote, the way, the truth, and the life, no one comes to the Father but by me, end quote?
Well, you know, it's all interpretive. So, you know, I don't even... If someone were to take it literally, you would have, then I have to figure out, well, what does it mean literally? And what does by me mean? And then, going, like, through him or by him is what exactly? And you know, there are a lot of interpretations. My interpretation would be a little like I know in my own heart, it has nothing to do with what anybody else has to say or another person has written about or a large group or small group of people think. It doesn't matter to me.
Cobain, Vedder, Staley. Which personality do you think you're closest to?
I don't know. I'm sorry. I have things in common with all of them. Eddie's someone that I know a lot better than the other two. And, you know, I have many similar qualities and many that they're really, you know, he has actually a lot of really great qualities that I don't have. And in a lot of really inspiring qualities that I don't have, that are just naturally him. And there are certain aspects to me that I just don't, you know, I don't see in any of them. I think, you know, we have sort of a geographic link, and then we have a link where we were all musicians and songwriters to some degree, and you know, there are certain things that musicians and or songwriters kind of have in common, you know, or anyone creative, but those are all just normal average things, you know, that you could compare me to somebody that's on some street or boardwalk right now playing guitar for dollar bills, and you're going to find the same amount of as you would with me and any other person that is a famous musician or whatever. It's not even that much of a geographic link, because Eddie wasn't really born in the Northwest. Lane was. Maybe, like, if Lane and Kurt were still alive, we'd be exactly alike. I don't know. That I think about, like Andy Wood is someone who to me was in some ways more brilliant than all of us. I think Jeff Buckley was more brilliant, just more naturally talented and more like crazy brilliant than all of us. I think Jeff and Andy had something in common. Shannon Hoon kind of had this quality too, of a childlike kind of openness toward life, like a complete openness toward life that didn't seem to ever go away. All three of those guys had that. I never saw that in Lane or Kurt. You know, there was guardedness going on there. There's vulnerability, but also a lot of fucking stay back sort of armor happening. It was never something I noticed in Jeff or Andy. Andy didn't seem, he seemed to be completely raw and kind of defenseless and throw himself out there, for better or worse.
So let's say a series of terrorist attacks takes out electricity pretty much across the entire West. What would you see your role as musician, artist, doing?
I don't know. I would first be happy that, like, it's possible that I could, like, get up and
entertain the militia with an acoustic guitar, because you can still do that without electricity. It's funny because I've done like these web events where I'm playing acoustic guitar and singing, and that's it. And you know, it's available for people to go online and check out, and like I see the technology it takes to film it, to upload it, and then you know how far-reaching those events go all over the world, and yet all of it basically is designed to film, to capture, and then to present a guy sitting on a stool with an acoustic guitar singing. That's it. Nothing. There's nothing modern about what it is people wanted to see in it. So it makes me feel happy, of course. That makes me feel very encouraged. It makes me feel great about the fact that, first of all, that means pretty much I can count on what I've done and chosen to do for my whole life to always be somewhat relevant, even in an immediate sense. Another role, I suppose, would be, and this might not be because I'm a musician, but just because I seem to have, at least thus far as it's been tested, an ability to stay pretty calm and focused in times of craziness. And I haven't really been in too many situations where it's like chaos out from the outside and I have to take a leadership role. But when I have been in those situations, I'm pretty focused. So it depends on what it would be and what would happen. I mean, I thank God that, you know, I'm not in that situation. And it freaks me out when I see other people being thrown into that situation in this country, especially where we feel somehow impregnable sometimes, and like we have endless resources, and then something like Katrina happens, and everyone sort of watches in shock and feels helpless, and even people that went down there were kind of could easily become part of the problem. You know, it's really a horrible thing. So I thank God that I'm not in that situation.
Addiction recovery seems like a humbling process. How do you think it shaped your perspective on your fellow man?
I think it's, you know, there's a connection effect that it has, me and everybody else. You know, I came through a period of addiction where it was in isolation. It wasn't like out among people or out among friends or hanging out with people, where I was really being noticed a lot. So there's a lot of isolation going on, and in the process of like stopping that behavior and changing my life, which means basically changing everything in my life. It's very humbling and deep, you know. Surrounded by other people who have the same problem from all walks of life. And I was sort of forced to, as everybody is in that situation, to come to the conclusion that, you know, I'm not special. I'm not having this problem because I've got special needs and special emotional issues and no one understands me. Because when you get in a room with people and talk about it, you realize everybody's the same issue. Everybody got this, doing it for the same reasons, the same things. And whether it's a rich person, a poor person, a man, a woman, a housewife, a construction person, a software author, a lawyer, me. It all comes up for the same reasons. We all deal with it the same way. We all do the same shit. And we all have to basically use the same faculties to get over it. And that's ultimately, that ends up being a really good thing, you know, to realize that that's the truth. Because it's like, oh, okay, I'm not a misunderstood person who's alone in this and is dealing with substance abuse and alcohol abuse because it's my only recourse. It's what everyone thinks. And so that means that I don't have to do it, and that means that I got a lot of company in these that are my problems, and you know, that's helped me actually excel at everything that I was already pretty good at, and become like the most prolific songwriter I've ever been,
the best I've ever sang, I think, and on stage, the most focused I've ever been as a musician, creatively the most focused I've ever been in my personal life, the most available by sure, you know, I've ever been in my personal life. So it's all been nothing but good. I can't think of one bad thing that's come out of it. Except for I don't get to drink anymore.
That's awesome. I don't want to respect your time, so if I can, I'll throw three questions at you. Now you pick one. Okay. That'll be the last one. What inspired you to breathe new life into Michael Jackson's Billie Jean? If you were going to go blind in 24 hours, what would you want to see? And what perspective has fatherhood brought to your life?
Well, if I were going to go blind in 24 hours, I would want to sit with my children and watch Michael Jackson's Billie Jean video.
Good one. Thanks, man. Really appreciate it. Yes, looking forward to it. Thanks for your help, Andre.